Welcome to the Fly Fishing Rocky Mountain National Park podcast reference series, helping you get the most out of your fly fishing experience in the park. Whether you've fished the park many times or are planning your very first trip, the reference series podcast will certainly have something to make your next trip more successful and memorable. Hi, I'm Steve Schweitzer, author of A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park. Let's get right to today's podcast.
I've sailed the great blue waters and I've rode the raging rivers, been lost in the north.
Today my guest is Mike Cruz, co-owner of the Laughing Grizzly Fly Shop in Longmont, Colorado. We're going to discuss how to gear up for day hiking and fly fishing in the park. We'll talk about what to bring, what not to forget, and what to leave behind. We'll focus on day hikes today with another podcast on overnight trips to come. Mike and his fellow partner Scott Blay run hundreds of fly fishing trips in the park each year. There are a few others that know the park like Mike and his crew. He's also our handsome fly fishing model on the front cover of the book. So Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me here today, Steve. And yeah, all my guys, I guess I have you to thank for it. Call me, you know, the special guy on the cover. So I'm proud to be there, though. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, it helps sell the book. It's better than me, I'll tell you. So, well, I tell you what, let's break down the podcast into two parts. We're sitting here today in Mike's shop, so from time to time you might hear some customers in the background. You're going to get the real live experience by being in his shop. But let's break the podcast down into two parts, hiking and then fly fishing, and let's talk about hiking first. So, you know, Mike, let's face it, fishing in Rocky Mountain National Park is as much about the hike as it is fishing. You know, over 70% of the fishable water in the park requires a hike. You know, some are short and others are longer, but it makes sense that a fly fisher be prepared for the hike just as much for fly fishing itself. So here's my first question. Let's start with understanding what a day hiker will encounter while hiking. You know, what are the trails like? What are we going to experience?
Well, the trails up there, and it really does depend on where you go. Starting down low, the trails can be very uneventful, very easy to hike. Basically, like the book shows, on a scale of 1 to 5, a lot of them can be a 1. But as you push a little further on to get away from the crowds and you exceed that quarter mile point past where most people like to go, your trail is going to get a lot more rugged. You're going to have a lot of loose rubble, exposed trees, roots. You're going to run into a variety of different obstacles. Some can be very hazardous. If you're foraging up towards Forest Canyon, you're climbing over boulders in some places. So it can really get to be a tough place to go.
Yeah. Is that the case for most of the trails in the park that you've seen?
No, actually, most of the trails are very well groomed. They do have some elevation and grade changes, and the difficulty scale does go up and down. But if you get anywhere off the beaten path, you're going to find yourself in some pretty rigorous terrain. So I'd say 70 to 80% of the trails are pretty well groomed.
Yeah, I think that's true in my experience as well. So would you want to hike up in waders, or would you want to wear comfortable shoes, boots? What's your
opinion? I've done it both ways.
Yeah.
I've hiked up in waders, and you get to the top, and you're a complete puddle of water by the time you get to the top, and then you get to the top, and it starts snowing. So I found it to be sometimes easier to pack your waders up if your waders are what you're going to use for the day, if you're in that springtime or fall time era where you can get a snowstorm pretty quick. But, you know, depending on the time of the year, wet wading can be a good way to go too. So the gear you're going to use, good hiking boots, tennis shoes, your wading boots. A lot of the wading boots built today are good for hiking, and they're comfortable enough to hike in.
Yeah, and they're actually made. Some of them are made to be hiker walkers as well as felt bottom waders.
So I'd say, to answer the question, I guess tennis shoes would be just fine. But keep in mind, if you're going to wear tennis shoes and get wet, you need some type of change.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we're hiking up the trails and we're going to our fishing destinations, you know, what type of weather would we expect to find in the park?
That's a good one. Scott and I went up last week and we decided to go up on the Roaring River to find out ice off or ice on. And we got up to the top, and when we left, it was 55 degrees down below. We got up to the top of the Roaring, and it clouded up quick and started to snow. And there was no snow on the bottom, there was 3 feet of snow on the top. So the weather change, even though we're in an early spring, the weather change came extremely quick, and we were well prepared for it, but it was a very quick and rapid change from one extreme to the other, from 60 down to 30 degrees.
Okay, so how would you dress for that? What kind of jackets or sweaters would you take?
Well, overdress, I would say, to start with, and know that for every 1,000 feet you're going up, you're going to lose almost 5 degrees in temperature. So as you change your elevations, I would overdress the situation, and you can always peel clothing and put them in your pack as you get to the top, or you could start out light and put clothing on as you get to the top. But I would definitely want to be a little bit warmer than not, and actually a little bit uncomfortable to start the hike might not be a bad idea. That way you know you're not going to get there and be underdressed.
Yeah, yeah. Better to take stuff with you than to leave it behind and wish you had it. Yeah. So, you know, as we're hiking along the trail, you will see wildlife of some sort. Some days you see more than others, but, you know, what types of wildlife could you see?
You can see it all. I was standing in the Wild Basin with a client last year, and I looked up and I saw a calf moose come out of the trees, and 2 seconds later, here come mama, and not 15 feet behind me. So you'll see it all. Dick and I, Dick is one of my guides, and we were out fishing last year as well up in the upper Big Thompson, and mama bear and 2 cubs foraging right around the stream side. So it's all there. I was up hiking with a friend of mine to Mirror Lake one day, and we came across a bear coming down the trail towards us. So you're going to see everything: deer, elk, occasional bighorn sheep, occasional moose, and for the most part, pretty harmless if you give them their due diligence and go around them and let them do their thing and not try to impose or take a bunch of pictures. You'd be okay.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's a common question I get is, you know, what about the bears or the mountain lions? Well, you know what? I've been traipsing around in the park for 10 plus years. I've not seen a mountain lion yet. I've seen traces of them, but I've not seen a mountain lion yet. I've seen a few bear, but never have I felt threatened. Mm-hmm. Just leave them, you know, give them their space, let them get around to where they want to go, and on you go. So it's not really a hazardous situation if you treat it right. Now, what shouldn't we forget? What are some of those key things that you would recommend to anybody that you guide or that you go up and hike with?
Well, like what we tell everybody, you have to prepare for the worst of situations. Most people are going from a 5,000 foot elevation to the base of these mountains at 78, 79, 8,000. So just that 3,000 foot change alone is 15 degrees minimum. So you have to be prepared for cooler weather. When those clouds dip up over the top of the mountain, they form quick, they gather quick, and they get organized, and the rain comes down extremely fast. So rain jackets, polarized sunglasses would be a great thing. You're up in a higher elevation, you want something that's going to protect you from the UVB and UVA rays. Snacks, energy bars. I take a lot of trail mix with me. Definitely have some water. You want to stay hydrated. Again, you know, you're getting out of your comfort zones at 3,000 to 5,000 feet above what you're normally used to. So staying hydrated is a huge, huge deal when you're up there.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the things that I take in the early season until probably the 1st of August, which I consider that really the early season in the park. The season's so short, by the way. But, you know, bug dope. There's times,
absolutely,
you know, times I've been on a lake where it's just been almost insane. It just drives me nuts, and I pack it up and go because I can't handle it. So now I have bug dope in my fly fishing pack. So
yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, like you were mentioning that, if you go over to the Wild Basin side of the Rocky Mountain National Park, those are willows, swamps, stagnant water, and the mosquitoes are treacherous. There's more to fear there than any bear or moose that walk down the river.
And that's no doubt. So, all right, so we've got, you know, we've got kind of a list here. We want water, and we want a hat, we've got our little rain jacket. We've kind of overdressed. You got to put this in something. What do you put it in? What do you recommend?
I carry any type of pack will work well, but if you want to be a fly fisherman / hiker, there's a few packs, like Fish Pond makes a pack, where it's a full 2,500 cubic inch backpack, and then it's a removable chest pack. So you can drop your backpack, secure it, and go fish, and you're not lugging around 20 extra pounds, and you put it in a convenient place where you can get to it. So whenever I go a mile beyond a trail or down a trail or past my truck, I've always got some type of a day pack. And yeah, I do overpack, but it's nice to be able to pull a rain jacket out when it's raining. And you know, I went up there to the Roaring the other day, and we thought it was going to be cold. We looked and it looked like it was going to be cold, so I put on my heavy rain jacket, got all the way to the top to find out I lugged my light rain jacket with me. So I had, you know, twofold. So it doesn't hurt, as long as you're in some type of shape where you can handle that, it doesn't hurt you to take extra gear, and you want to be comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like a guide trick to me. Always, yeah. You know, almost like a Boy Scout, you know, be prepared.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I use a small fish pond waste pack. I think it's called the Water Dance, and that seems to do the trick for me. And then I also, if it's a long day hike where I'm going to do 15 miles plus, I'll throw on a backpack as well, and I'll stash it or hide it away, you know, while I'm fishing, and it seems to fit pretty well that way. Now, there's safety things to consider. What are some of the things you think about?
Well, we do prep our clients right away that if they're coming in from, for instance, New York City, and they're coming in on Tuesday and they want a guide on Wednesday, I try to steer them into 2 days out. That way they have time to get here, get acclimated, and get themselves hydrated a little bit. We're very big about that. If, and this does happen a lot, we have a lot of businessmen that want to get out for 4 hours that come from low-lined areas, and we just tell them water, 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 because that's what's going to keep you from getting a headache, getting lightheaded, getting some altitude sickness. So we really steer towards the safety portion of it. And you get up in there and they start getting a headache, you're done. You got to turn them and pack them back out, because it'll get worse before it ever gets better. Yeah. Once they get to that point.
Yeah, and I've even been on some hikes in the park where I've gotten headaches. I've gotten some altitude sickness. Just I don't know why. I can't explain it. It's happened twice to me in the past 10 years. So even happens to those who live near here.
And then you got hypothermia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in the fringe seasons, like now. You know, it's 72 degrees in Estes Park today, most likely. It's a really nice day here. But if you get up to Bear Lake Trailhead, which is just, you know, 15 minutes up the road into the park, it could be 50. And that's the trailhead. And if you go higher, it could be 40. Absolutely. And in the 30s. So, yeah, hypothermia. Frostbite is less so of a concern unless you're going to be doing some multi-day overnight pack trips in the snow and so forth. But, you know, there is one thing that I do get a question about once in a while is ticks. And there are ticks in the park. I've had a couple. But from my research, I found that the ticks that cause any sort of disease that's problematic to humans is not found in the park. Those ticks are typically associated with white-tailed deer, and there are no white-tailed deer in the park. It's all mule deer. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you've run into ticks or not. Or
I've gotten a few back when I had a full head of hair, but they don't want to stay in my head now because there's nothing up there to cover. But I've gotten a few in the past few years, but if you check yourself, take proper measurements, ticks aren't really an issue. I have, and I'm in those trees all the time.
Yeah, willows and so forth.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and you see them, and I've seen them on my clothing and stuff, and you just brush them off. It's, I just don't think they're that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think the mosquitoes are a bigger threat.
I would agree with you. I want to go back to that water thing for a second before we move on. Now, you can bring in water bottles. You can overpack water sometimes. Now, water weighs almost 9 pounds a gallon, so it can be a pretty heavy thing to tote around.
Absolutely.
How do you bring water in? How do you treat that?
I do two different ways. I have a little purifier that fits on a plastic water bottle. So you fill your plastic water bottle, you screw this purifier on, and it filters 200 gallons of water. If I'm going in for any length of time, or I have more than one person to take care of, I bring a Canadine water filter. It does weigh a little bit. It's almost 14 ounces, but you're not worried about the quality of your water at that point. So there's, like I said, there's two things you can use. You can actually use a filtered water bottle or the filter that fits on top of those plastic, just regular plastic 16 ounce water bottles.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a kind of rule of thumb that I use when I take water up there to kind of augment what you're saying. is, you know, these little 500 milliliter, 16.9 fluid ounce bottles of water. I'll take a couple of those if I'm going to be out for a couple hours. If I'm going to be out past a couple of hours, I'll take a filter like you recommend, because it's just more weight efficient than to carry around, you know, a bunch of water. So, yeah, that's pretty important stuff for our listeners to understand, that water and probably a little bit of ibuprofen in your backpack are a good thing. Well, let's talk about what's most important to a fly fisher. You know, what types of water could a day hiker come across in the park?
You'd come across anything from a stream you can step across to a stream you can't wade across. And, you know, take for instance Mill Creek. It's a stream that's very small. It feeds into Glacier Creek, and it's chock full of fish. But you can literally step across this stream in a lot of places. Or you could run up towards the Big Thompson, where when it's in a runoff season or a heavy water season, you can't hardly wade across that river.
Yeah, yeah.
So you see every aspect of the waters. And for the Rocky Mountain National Park, every basin of water up there is actually considered to be small water. But there is big small water and there's little small water, and some of the bigger water that's up there can be pretty treacherous.
Yeah, yeah. What are your recommendations for wading those types of streams, or should we even attempt it?
Definitely have a wading staff. And when you're going into those smaller streams, you want to take one step at a time, and I would not go above my waist at any given time in any one of those streams, because the water is funneled. It's funneled down very tight, and if it's in within its banks, then it has no release except downriver. So it's built up a lot of pressure, and people don't realize the pressure till they're halfway across.
Yeah.
Then they have no option. They don't know where to go, and that's what usually takes people down. Is they have nowhere to go, and they try to turn around to go back from where they came, rather than taking 10 more steps to cross, maybe going 50 feet down the river while they're doing it would be a safer avenue. But a lot of people make that turn, and as soon as they turn around and broadside the water, they're gone.
Yeah, yeah. It's surprising how fast this water can flow in these small streams in the park, especially during runoff. And we're going to have a heck of a runoff season this year. I can see it. Yeah, there's also lakes that we can encounter when we go up, you know, up a hike on a trail. But in my experience, those lakes, you know, start around 9,500 feet and a little higher. So it does require a longer hike to get to some good fishing lakes. Although there are some lakes that are drive by or walk by, you know, Lily Lake on the edge of the park. You got Sprague Lake.
Right to it.
Yeah, yeah. So. Okay, you want to go fish these lakes and rivers and streams. What rod would you bring?
You could bring 3 or 4 different type rods, but if you had to pick one rod, and I have a favorite, I bring a 7'10" 3-weight. And the reason 7'10", it's not a super short rod, it's not a super long rod, but it's good for almost every aspect of what you can do in the park. You can get into tight willows, and you can still get in there and effectively cast. And, you know, if you had the ability to pack a rod and bring a rod, then I would bring 2 versatile rods, a 3 and possibly a 4-weight. Maybe a 4-weight, a little longer, 9-foot, 8.5-foot, something that you can fish some of those lakes with and actually get an effective cast out. Into the wind, you know, you get up to some of those lakes, high mountain lakes up at 8, 9, 10,000 feet, and they're in a bowl and the wind comes through and you can't cast into them. And so a longer 4-weight rod would be nice to have as well.
Yeah, yeah. So essentially 2 rods is really the optimal way to go. You got a 3-weight, maybe a 4 or 5-weight, depending upon the length,
right,
and you're comfortable in casting. But that longer, stiffer rod would be more applicable to lake fishing, and that shorter rod would be getting you inside the willows and the smaller stream fishing. Yeah. Any special reels we got to consider when we put on these rods?
If you're hiking for effectiveness, and what I mean by that is you're checking the ounces of what you're bringing in, then the reel is actually pretty essential, because that can weigh up to 1 pound in some cases if you have a die cast reel, and so it can add a lot of weight to what you're doing for the day. But in terms of actuality and functionality, no, there isn't really a big specification. I use a Click and Paul, and there are several Click and Pauls out there. Reddington makes a good one. Lamson has a pretty decent Click and Paul style type reel, and then Sage also has a really nice super ultra light Click and Paul type reel. But for the most part, a reel is something to hold your line when you're up in the park like that. Most of the fish come in by stripping. So you don't need or have the necessity to really put fish on the reel in most cases up there.
Right, right. So if we didn't take a reel up and we took a big long rod, it'd be that.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, Tenkara fishing. It's the new, you know, really, Rocky Mountain National Park is quickly becoming the epicenter of Tenkara fishing. And I'm going to be actually be trying it for the first time this year. I've ordered my rod. Can't wait to get it.
That's cool.
What have you dipped into that a bit at all?
I have, and I actually kind of dipped into it by accident. And I this is a story that really didn't happen in the park, but I'm going to tell it anyway. And I have some private water, and there's some big fish on my private water. And a friend of mine wanted to try his Tenkara rod. Well, I thought I'd get a chuckle out of it by setting him up on my private water. Nice rod. He's got 13 foot. It's got some nice extended reach to it. And he got right out there, and he was hooking into some nice fish. Well, he hooked a 7-pound rainbow.
I don't know if that's made for that.
It's not. And I did it on purpose because I was giving him a bad time about using a Tenkara rod. So I got a big laugh out of it because he had to lay the rod down and pull the fish in hand over fist. So it was very funny, but effectively, the rod worked very well. And he was bringing in some actually fairly nice fish. He was bringing in 12, 14-inch fish.
Yeah.
He was doing it effectively. But when he hooked into that big one,
it
was a 26-inch rainbow.
Yeah. And I think that's...
And he had nowhere to go.
A bit outside the range of a Tenkara rod. And just for definition, a Tenkara rod is an extendable rod that can go from 11 to 14 feet in most cases with a fixed leader of about the same length. And so you kind of use the old school way of fishing back in the 1700s.
I do recommend, though, and the old school way is actually, it's pretty cool to think of, but when you're doing the fixed leader thing, your Tenkara rod's going to come with some furled leaders, and I highly recommend putting those on the mantle next to Grandpa's shotgun, because there's two things about furled leaders. If you've ever fished them, if you snag on anything or set up in a tree and you pull them out, they will coil on you to the point where they're almost unretrievable, and at that point, you're almost done fishing unless you have something else to exchange it with. So I would get into an actual tapered type leader or a hand tied type leader, something other than a furled. Furled's are pretty cool. That's a great leader, and it is old school.
Yeah.
But I think you'd be better served using a 10-foot tapered type leader, a 10-foot hand type leader.
Yeah, level line of some
level
sort.
Level line of some sort, absolutely.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to Tenkara fishing this year.
Cool.
Now, going back to conventional fly fishing itself, you know, you've got fly lines, you got leaders and tippets. What type of line was best for the park?
I use a light line, and Rio puts out a really good trout line. It's called Trout LT, and the reason I like it so much is because of the weighting in the head. And the body, it has an excellent roll cast. And in fishing the park, you need some type of roll cast in most places. There's no or not a lot of room where you can pick up and cast 30 feet behind you or 20 feet behind you and dip it back into the water again. So you need the ability, in some cases, to roll cast up the river. And in some of our gin clear waters, just a pick up and a lay down isn't going to cut it because you're too close to the fish. The fish can see you. So you need a 10 or 15 or 20 foot cast in there. And you have no room to cast, so getting a nice roll cast out there. And that Trout LT does that very well. It's one of the best lines I've seen that can pick up a nice roll cast and still give that presentation and let your fly out.
Very nice. What kind of leaders do you use?
You know, I use a tapered leader, just a 7.5 foot, 6X. I do use monofilament on my leaders. And if I need any type of extensions or anything, I actually do use a fluorocarbon extension. I've weighed the odds, and I know everybody says fluorocarbon is going to be here till life ends. Well, so is monofilament. It doesn't break down and deteriorate much faster than fluorocarbon does. So if people police and clean up after themselves, using the best thing you can use is going to be better for your fishing day. And fluorocarbon has a little bit more of an invisibility in there. I don't use a fluorocarbon leader just because I always extend my leaders anyway.
Yeah.
And so I don't find a necessity to spend the extra money on a fluorocarbon leader when I can pick up some fluorocarbon tippet and get a lifetime of use out of the tippet versus short time of use out of the
Absolutely. You know, you brought up a really good point earlier about packing out what you pack in, you know, your leaders and your split shot that you are excess or you take off and, you know, exchange throughout the day. I even make a habit of picking up one or two pieces of stuff I find on the trail from someone else so that I'm doing my part to add to removing trash out of the park. So I think it's a really good message to pass along here.
And we caught a goose last year in the park that was so bound up with monofilament that there was no way it was going to survive. And we actually physically ran him down, and he was running, but his wings were just bound up.
And we
caught him and cut him free, but it was pretty sad to see how tore up and the monofilament was cutting through into his neck. And so it really is, you know, people need to learn to pack out, and most people do, but it's the maybe 1% that just throw it down, or it's only a piece this big, rip it off and throw it away.
Yeah.
If you get a little trash can or have an open pocket in your vest and you trim off that piece, just throw it in your vest, you'll get 90% of your trash out, if not more.
Yeah.
With trying to get 100, you're always going to miss a piece or lose a piece, or wind's going to pick something up out of you. But it drives me crazy to see people not packing things out.
Yeah.
And I pick up a lot of trash in the rivers.
Yeah, you know, I found rods in the park, one shoe, a sock. You know, those things I have a tolerance for, because most likely it fell out of the pack or someone just forgot it. It's the cigarette butts and the half of the wrapper of a energy bar that really, really annoy me, because those are cognizant drops from someone just purposely littering. Not caring. So, yeah, we'll do our part for sure. Now, we talked a little bit about leaders and tippets. What goes on the end of a tippet? A fly. You know, what's your favorite fly for the park? Come on now, fess that up. You're a guide. You're a fly shop owner. You see it all.
Yeah, am I fishing or am I guiding? If I'm guiding, then, you know, it's a tan tick or a Los Alamos ant, some big type of stimulator on top of the water, and about 14 inches below it, drop a San Juan worm.
Yeah.
And it's effective, and say what anybody wants to say, it is a very, very effective tool to catching fish in the park. And I'm not a traditionalist, but when I'm fishing by myself, I just darn near refuse to use them.
Yeah.
And I try to catch them on other things. And we have a variety, great variety of bug life in the state of Colorado. And the park is no slouch. I catch fish on an ant pattern from ice on, or from ice off to ice on.
Yeah.
So March, April, you're catching them on ants on top, and you go back down to October, November, and you're catching them on ants on top. So you can get away with almost anything. And when you're with a client, it's a different situation. You're trying to get them into fish.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so when you're by yourself or you're off on your own, you're trying to learn what is working. I was up there 2 weeks ago and saw grasshoppers. They're already out.
Yeah.
So the fish are keen to it. You know they are. So you can get in, look at the rivers, and decide what bug life. Blueing olives, it's a massive hatch up there. We have a stonefly all winter long that comes out and hatches. Most people think it's a midge in the snow, but it's actually a stonefly.
Yeah.
And so there's an abundance of bug life. So the shortage of what to use really isn't out there. Red quills, little greenstones. There are some green drakes that come off up in the park. You have got to have the pink and purple San Juan worm in your box if you're having a bad day and nothing else is working.
Now say that again. A pink and a purple.
A pink and a purple.
Okay.
There's a fly shop that calls it the pink one is Victoria's Secret and the purple one is Barney. So have Victoria's Secret and Barney, or Barney's little sister. But if you're having a rough day and you're not getting into any fish, put on a San Juan worm.
Yeah.
Straight up. It's a great fly.
Absolutely. Now, would you have a different choice of flies for a lake versus a stream situation?
It depends on the lake, actually. There's some lakes, like we go up to Lily quite a bit, and Chronomids work in that lake fairly well. But I've been to Sprague Lake, where you can use identical flies stream to lake. And they're in close enough nature to each other where you're not going to have that much of a variety. But Lily is kind of pushed off on its own, and it has a different style of bug life.
Yeah.
And it really, truly does. So there's going to be some flies we're going to use differently. And I went up to Mirror Lake last year, and I used a red humpy.
Yeah.
And did really well with it. And it was in a good time of year and everything, but I think that you can get away with a lot of the same flies.
Yeah.
You don't have to outthink the world. I think I packed up 15 boxes full of flies and used three.
But then again, you're a guide. We have to remind yourself
exactly.
Of that.
Exactly. Go nowhere without everything.
That's right. So let's say that you had a small fly box with six slots in it. What six flies would you take, bar none, every time in the park?
Parachute Adams, Griffith's Net, San Juan Worm, El Caracatus, and some type of big stimmy.
Okay. All right, I think that's five. You shorted
your fly. And, you know, works all the time. Not all the time, but a lot of times is a Copper John.
Yeah, classic.
Classic fly, and yep. It works really well.
Get yourself down quick. We talked a little bit about waders earlier when we were hiking. In the summer, what would you take?
Actually, I would take up my wading boots, and I would wet wade. In most of the places in the park, the water temps come up enough where it's tolerable. If you're not standing in it for hours on end, just crossing back and forth. What most people don't understand is the necessity to wade in the park is more of a crossing river thing than it is walking up and down a river and fishing it. And in some cases you have to, but in a lot of cases you can walk the banks and stay fairly warm and dry and then cross the river when you need to or get in the water when you need to. But if you're gonna take a wader, I like some waist ties. It's comfortable. They're not constrictive. A breathable style, just a waist high type pant wader.
Yeah.
And it works really well. Something light in material. You're not going for bomb proof.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So either wet wade with some sort of felt bottom or Aqua Sole type bottom sandal, boot, or light waders.
A sandal, you know, if you're wet wading, definitely want to just be comfortable with it. And I don't use a sandal. I wear my boots. I have a very comfortable set of boots, and I hike in them as well as wade in them. And so I don't find the necessity to pack in different items. And if I'm walking a long distance and wading and getting wet, then I'll have a pair of tennis shoes or something to walk out in.
Sure.
And a pair of dry socks.
Okay. Well, would you take a float tube up to a high mountain lake?
Absolutely.
Really?
I wouldn't even hesitate. I go to Long Draw Reservoir, which is on the northern end of the park, and that lake has got some of the biggest cuts in it in the state. There's some just beautiful cuts in there, and you can float the inlet to that lake. You can float all the way down around the dam. It's actually a very large lake for
high mountains. Yeah, it is.
And I find it's not a necessity. You can catch a lot of fish off the banks, but you get in a float tube and pitch it out there and throw in a woolly bugger or something like that and just start kicking and trolling, really. And you'll be surprised what kind of fish you pick up.
Yeah.
And the ability to hang right at the inlet when all that water's coming in from the Grand Ditch and those fish are trying to force their way up into the ditch, pick up a lot of fish right there at that inlet as they're staging to go in. So, yeah, I'd take a float tube and not just long draw. You know, there's other lakes you can pack it into. It just depends on what your stamina is.
Yeah. Anything else that we shouldn't forget if we're packing up as a fly fisher?
You have a checklist, a mental checklist, and I don't write it down, but I have a mental checklist. You know, example, make sure you got your fishing license.
Yeah, that's great.
Make sure you're telling somebody where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have longitude and latitudes of the area, or at least the trailhead that you're going to be going on, because who's to say that you find a beautiful spot on the stream and it's 100 yards off the trail and you duck in there and you break your leg. So you need somebody to know where you're going at all times, at least to a specific area of the park. That way if somebody has to come out and look for you, they can.
Absolutely.
Make sure you have extra tippet, extra leaders, weight. And when you're packing in weight, the park has a voluntary regulation on split shot.
Yeah.
And they ask you not to use lead. We try to enforce that. Yes, as a fly shop owner, I sell it all.
Yeah.
And depending on the circumstances, I even use it all. But I'd say 80% of the time there's no lead in my vest.
Yeah.
And when I'm with clients, I absolutely have no lead in the vest. And you don't want to give the wrong perception that it's okay for me to do what I want to do and them to do what they're being asked to do. So the park doesn't have a mandated, but they ask you to.
Yeah.
So we abide by that. And on our trips, nobody carries lead. It's something I do not allow.
Yeah.
So just to help preserve something that we have
going on in
the park. It is one of our greatest resources.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly.
I'll say, you know, 80% of the time or greater, I'm fishing a dry fly anyhow, and I almost have no need to take up any weight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it adds to your weight, literally adds to your weight of your pack, too. And
every ounce counts.
And those rivers and streams are shallow enough that you can sink a fly with a good drift.
Yeah. Yeah. I most of the time I'll fish a weighted fly, and that'll be enough for the shallow streams or the hole I want to drift through. And I use a strike indicator more as a depth gauge than anything else. And rarely do I put any weight on a line. So now, what shouldn't you pack? There are some things that the park doesn't allow, and you know, what should you leave at home?
You know, in terms of the fishing aspect of it, I see a lot of people up there bait fishing, and the park does allow children under a certain age to use bait, but they have to use a regular standard hook that the barbs are pinched down on. They can't use treble hooks and things like that. So, you know, I'd say like the treble hooks and the big gear that you don't really need up there anyway. And number one, bait fishing is not allowed. For the most part, anybody above the age of 13 cannot use it as it is.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of power bait jars. I see worm cans. I pick up a lot of trash, and a lot of that trash is left behind by people that are bait fishing and so forth. And I'm not saying they're the problem, but it's definitely a contributing factor.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you know, power baits are super popular and super effective. You know, those moldable, scented baits are not allowed in the park, but we do see it. So, you know, let's switch gears for a second and let's discuss now how your fly shop. And I want to talk about your fly shop a little bit. You know, thanks for spending your time with me this afternoon and on doing this. I'd like people to know a little bit about Laughing Grizzly, one of the premier shops, in my opinion, gateway to the park, full service guide operation, full service shop, tying rods. I mean, you name it.
You've got to do it.
Yeah. So, you know, what kind of, when someone calls you up, or someone walks in the store and they're out of state, a visitor out here for their first big Rocky Mountain fly fishing experience, they ask you a few questions. What kind of info can you provide them? How can you help them?
Well, we do a couple of different things. The gentleman that puts together our website, and on our website we have what we call a fish log. You know, everybody's got a fishing report, and we have one as well, and it tells you stream reports, water flows, what hot flies to use. But we also have a fish log, and that's where my guides, myself, and friends of the shop have fished lately, and we get a report back from them. We post it directly on the fish log. So we can steer people in that direction, and if they actually come into the shop, and that's if a person calls, hey, I'm in from out of town,
yeah,
you know, what can I do? Well, go to my website, go to the fish log, this will give you specifics. And if they walk into the shop, you know, if they're from out of town, honestly, Steve, we kind of hold their hand a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I want them to have a good experience.
That's your job as a shop.
It is my job as a shop. And I know that rubs some people the wrong way in the terms of giving away secrets or telling people the great places to go. But, you know, there's so much water and so many places to fish. You can't give away all the secrets. And there's so many secrets that are undiscovered. And I have no qualms about telling people places to fish.
I'm laughing with you because the park, it almost all the water fishes exceptionally well throughout the prime, you know, summer months. You can send anybody anywhere and they have a really good chance of catching fish.
Absolutely.
Even at a modest skill level. So there almost are no secrets, yet at the same time the park is so undiscovered and there's so many other little places that you and I haven't even been to.
It is, and I've lived in Longmont my whole life, almost 50 years. And I've been fishing that park for most of my life.
and in the area of the park, and there's so many places that I've never discovered. And like when you took me up to Mirror Lake this last year, and I recently discovered the power of the Poudre Creek, not the Poudre River, but the Poudre Creek.
Right.
And unbelievable. And yeah. to get in there on a walk that's only a couple miles long and not find anybody in places like that, just because it's a little bit difficult, it just makes it that much more rewarding. So I don't have a problem sending Ed from Pennsylvania to Long Draw Reservoir. You know, number one, it's a 2.5 hour drive. It's an hour hike in. Most people are going to shun that and say, no, I don't want to do it. If I'm going to drive 3 hours, I'm going to go to a big fish water.
Yeah.
So what people don't understand is if you take out the exception of the size of the fish, and the park does have some big fish in it, but if you take out the everyday exception and say, okay, nobody has big fish, there's nowhere... nowhere in the state that has any big fish. Everything is 8 to 12 inches and that's it. The park is a world-class fishery.
Yeah.
Straight up.
Yeah.
If you want to factor in size issues, then no, it doesn't compare to the Yampa or to the Dream Stream or places like that where they house 5 and 6 pound fish. But, you know, big fish fix can only get you so far.
Right.
And with every step in the park, your scenery changes.
It's really not about the fishing the more I fish up there. It's about the hike in. It's what I see, what I experience, people I talk to. So, you know, fishing is just like the icing on the cake, in my opinion.
And it's a place I've never had to sell.
Yeah, exactly. It sells itself.
It sells itself, and I don't have to. Where do you guys guide? Oh, we got in the park. Oh, really?
Yeah,
you know, and we do guide a lot of other waters, but the park is our basis.
Yeah,
I mean, it's where we guide the most.
In fact, we will interview Dick Shinton, one of your lead guides, in an upcoming podcast about the business of guiding in the park and what a guide goes through to prepare for a day, and you know, how a guide really studies and practice is hard to make that day on the water the best ever for the client. But, you know, we'll talk about that in another podcast. But, you know, your shop does offer guided fly fishing trips. You know, give us a sneak peek on what a guided trip can do to help teach someone about fly fishing in the park.
Well, and guided trips, you know, and you've been fly fishing a long time, and so have I. And I get a guided trip on any water that I've never been to before.
Yeah.
It does two things for you. It gives you local knowledge, and you're paying somebody for some secrets that maybe you'd have a hard time figuring out on your own. But a guided trip can be for anyone, either with great fishing experience or somebody that has never fished or just wants to get out there for a good wholesome day of fun. So you can use it as an educational tool. You can use it as a, hey, I've got 4 hours to burn. Where can you take me? So all skill levels.
Yeah.
But what a guided trip does for the beginner or the novice is it gives them the tools to actually shave years off your learning curve.
Yeah.
So if you come into the shop and say, hey, I've never done this before, you know, what do I need? What do I need to outfit with? And what I do is I steer them into a guided trip. And yeah, it can be kind of a sales pitch, but what I don't want is that customer to come in and drop $500 on gear, go out, get completely frustrated with it and drop the sport altogether.
Yeah.
So you steer them into a little 4 hour trip, you give them the insight, they don't buy a single thing. They buy the trip, they go out, they figure out, hey, this is what I want to do. Then they come back in and you can gear them properly. I can almost guarantee you on an 80 or 90% scale that if you walk into the store and you buy a rod and a reel, flies, a box, you drop $500 in the store, and you don't want the guided trip, I can almost guarantee you with certainty that you're going to be back frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that fly fishing is hard. It's actually easy to learn, a lifetime to master.
Yes, and, great comment.
But it is a light switch, and you can send somebody out there when the lights are off and they have all the right gear, all the right bugs. The difference between a good day and a bad day could be a piece of split shot and how high you put it on your line.
Yeah.
So those are invaluable things, and that's what the guide is for. He's there to teach you the invaluable things, the things you have to learn on your own or that take a lifetime to master that you're picking his brain on in a 4, 6, or an 8-hour day. So I think it's an essential tool, and I use it today. When I go to a new water, I get a guide.
Absolutely.
At least for a half day.
Absolutely. You and I both know Pat Dorsey, mm-hmm. And I used to live down in the South Denver area and always found fishing the South Platte somewhat challenging. I mean, I got fish, and sometimes I'd walk out with no fish, but I wanted to do better. I called Pat up one day and said, you know, I need you to take me out for a day. I learned how to spot fish the way Pat Dorsey spots fish. And I use that tactic now on other waters I go to, and it has helped immensely. So not just the South Platte drainage, but everywhere I go now. You know, I'm learning what
Absolutely.
He taught me.
Absolutely.
So what a great thing to do is to get a guide.
And you know, a great guide like that, or you get somebody like Landon Mayer.
Yeah.
Whenever they throw an invite, hey, why don't you join us one of these days? Jump all over that.
Yes, right.
It is the most invaluable thing you'll ever do, because those guys, just like any other guide, you know, and I'm not saying they're any better than some of the people we have here. It's just a different perspective on how they do things on different waters.
That's right.
And I wouldn't go to the Madison up in Montana and say, I'm a guide.
Right. Yeah.
So, because you're just going to be a foolish guide at that point. You don't know the water. And knowing the water is what it's all about. And
yeah.
That's what these gentlemen here that work for me and work in this shop, they specialize in knowing what's local and what's around here. And I'd like to, you know, I have to say that I'm biased, but I probably have undoubtedly probably the best staff going.
Yeah.
And I can honestly tell you.
And I can see the pride in your face. And I know many of them, just a few that I don't know, but I can tell you that I've learned from all of them. So you do have a whale of a staff here.
Thank you.
So, you know, a fly shop does cater to the fly fishing crowd. We talked about the guiding thing. We'll dip into that later in another podcast. But, you know, what kind of things could a hiker, fly fisher get from your shop when they walk in? You know, the Pennsylvania guy, Ed, he comes in your shop.
And Ed is a real guy, by the way.
Yeah, okay.
From Pennsylvania.
Well, Ed, I hope you're listening. you know, you come into the shop, you know, what could he buy here, and what would he have to be prepared for otherwise?
Well, and we have, like, if you're going to be camping or doing anything like that, we have bear-proof containers.
Yeah.
And so we have those to offer, which the park requires them.
Park does require it.
You're going to be doing any type of overnight or longevity type stay, they require it. And then also we have sunglasses, sunscreen, bug spray, buffs, you know, they cover your face, protect you from
right.
the sun. We have a lot of things that the hiking community can utilize. We don't have a few of the things they're going to need, but we have walking sticks or wading sticks. So we can educate and gear up a hiker fairly well
yeah.
in our shop.
You even have rain jackets and
oh yeah,
shirts
absolutely.
And so
think
forth.
About that.
So.
Rain jackets and shirts and pullovers, fleeces, hoodies.
Yeah.
I mean, we do have a wide variety of selection. I think where we lack the most, and I'm not afraid to say it, is hiking boots. But
well,
then we have wader boots that
yeah.
are as good as hiking boots.
Yeah. So. But you're a fly fishing shop, not a hiking shop per se,
right.
you know. You don't want to find snowboards here in the winter, so. but that's good. Now, you know, interestingly, Laughing Grizzly, great logo, very characteristic, iconic logo. It's easy to spot, easy to recognize. You know who it is when you look at it. How the heck did you get your name, Laughing Grizzly?
That's interesting, because we've been asked that since the day we opened the doors. Where did the name come from? I had a biker, not a fly fisherman. He came in on his motorcycle one day. He said, I had to flip a U-turn. He goes, do you have hats? Because your logo's awesome. So it makes you feel good when you hear that. But the true story, how we came up with it, or actually, you know what I'll do is I'll tell you what we used to tell everybody. And we used to say, you know, that you as a fly fisherman, you spend a lot of money, a large amount of time, huge effort. You get your rod and your reel and your line and your flies, and you go out there, and to no avail, you know, you strive for that one fish of the day, and then you look up and there's the grizzly bear standing on a rock, and a fish just jumps in his mouth, eager to go.
Yeah.
And so we used to say, well, that's the bear on the rock laughing at you. So that's where we came up with the name. You know, the grizzly is actually laughing at us because we're a poster child for a fly fishing video, and he just stands on the rock and the fish jump in. But in all honesty, the true name came. Scott and I were throwing names back and forth, and you know, we opened in 07, but we've been
literally, we put the company together in 04, you know, and we've been transpiring for two and a half years getting everything going and to open this place right. And so we've been throwing names around for probably 2.5, 3 years. And he came out one day and he goes, "What about Laughing Grizzly?" And I just went, "No way."
Yeah, bingo.
Yeah, I was like, "Oh my God, that's it. Now what do we do?"
Yeah, right.
You know, so we wanted a name that you're not going to forget.
Yeah.
And not that anybody will forget other shop names, but when people see it, they don't know whether we're a bar. And so we get all kinds of traffic that come in, you know, even though it says Fly Shop across the building, bigger than life. People walk in and think, well, we thought maybe it was a bar or something, you know, a Laughing Grizzly bar. But so we just wanted a name that everybody would relate to and not forget.
Yeah.
And Scott actually came up with the name.
Yeah. What a great name. It fits well.
Thank you.
Fits the personality of the store, the people that work in the store, happy-go-lucky, super informative people. You know, we've covered a lot. I think we should probably wrap it up here. How can the audience get a hold of you at Laughing Grizzly in case they have more questions or want to talk to you further about some guiding opportunities?
Great. Actually, they can get a hold of us a variety of ways. We have a website, laughinggrizzlyflyshop.com. You don't need to remember that. Remember the name, just Laughing Grizzly. If you put that in your Google, it'll come right up. We're also located in Longmont on the northwest end of town. And it's, if people are living in the area, it's also known as the Old Dairy Store.
Yeah.
And we're at 10675 Ute Highway, which is also Highway 66. And then our phone number is 303-772-9110. And we are a full-service fly shop. We are more than elated to hear from anybody. We'd love people to come in and just give them a little bit of information. No need to buy. Stop by, just say hi, ask what's going on. We have a lot of rivers locally.
Yeah.
And then the Rocky Mountain National Park is a whopping 35 minutes away.
Yeah.
So it's a long drive. And, you know, I can leave here at 6, hit Wild Basin, and still get a 3-hour fish in.
Yeah.
Before dark in the summertime. So it's a great place to go, but a great place to be.
Yeah. You know, Mike, I want to thank you for taking the time to sit with me today and kind of go over hiking and fishing in the park from your perspective, telling us a little bit about your shop and how it came about. And those of you who are listening in, appreciate you tuning in today to our second podcast in the podcast reference series. And if you have any questions about what we talked about today, feel free to email me at steve@flyfishingrmnp.com. Well, Mike, thanks a lot for taking time to share your thoughts with us today, and thanks everyone for listening in.
You know, I do want to thank Mike again for taking the time to visit with me today. In case you want to contact the shop directly, I wanted to pass along his email as well, laughinggrizzly@comcast.net. Or you can call them directly at 303-772-9110. You can also visit their website at laughinggrizzlyflyshop.com and click on the contact link. Our next podcast will feature guest Dick Shinton, a longtime park guide, who will share a day in the life of a guide, discussing how a guide prepares for every trip to make it the best day possible for every client. Be sure to listen to the next podcast as he'll share some local guide wisdom and secrets for fishing the park.
Let it rain.
Really? One take?
Let it rain a whole lot more, cause I got them deep.
Hi, I'm
River Blue.
Hi, I'm welcome.
Let that rain.
Okay, that's quite a podcast. Right,
we need some.
We need some beer.
Can we grab a couple beers?
Okay. Damn it, I'm gonna do this again. I'm gonna do it right this time.